Getaway Friday Morning, Friday, August the 4th, 2023, first Friday in the month of August, 15 minutes past the hour. You're tuned in to Over the Back Fence with Pastor Steve Whitaker and myself. Heard live every Friday morning, 9:15 to 10 a.m. here on this station. Repeated on Sunday morning, 8:15 to 9 a.m. and Wednesday and Thursday afternoon, 3:15 to 4 p.m. Also, if you want to listen, go to the website, wwgh1071.com. Go to Program Archives. It's the first show under there. And usually by the end of the day today, if you go to our Facebook page, you will see the link to listen to the show. Pastor Whitaker, here we are on another Friday. It's the month of August. School will be back in very shortly. And where has summer gone?
Yeah, it's been a pretty fast summer, I think. I am Pastor Steve Whitaker from Community Christian Fellowship at 209 East Water Street in Prospect, Ohio. Love to see you on 10:30 on Sunday mornings, and we have many other services, but I won't get into that right now. I do want to give a plug in here to Jeff's Bicycle Shop and also Mid-Ohio Insurance Solutions, which does a wonderful work with your Medicare. Wow, what a busy week it's been.
It really has. I was saying before we went on the air, we had the thing on Monday with Governor Celeste at the Historical Society. We had the centennial of Harding's death, which was an elongated program for us. We were here with Jack Kellogg last night, former mayor, looking at his memorabilia.
Busy.
Busy.
Busy, busy. You know, we were just talking about before we got on the air how busy we are, and we just seem to go and go. But, you know, you can even have peace of mind at that, I think. I think you can. You know, Frank has been Frank's pretty good. Frank Robinson's here in the background this morning. I think he's keeping me in check. By the way, ladies, he's an eligible bachelor if anybody would like to
there you go.
Frank's pretty excited. He just inherited his uncle's tractor this week, and he got it home, and he's going to get to play with that. But anyway, God has been good to us, and it's been a I told everyone, I think we had a great Bible school this year, and getting ready to kick off Team Kid again this year for the kids on Tuesday evenings when school starts. And I got some exciting news. I've got one granddaughter that teaches here in the Marion system. She teaches first grade, and my daughter Holly is going to be a first grade teacher at Elgin this year.
Oh, very nice.
She's got her own classroom, and I think that's pretty exciting for her. A lot going on. Something I was thinking about this morning, you know, in a subject. So now I'm walking up to Scott, and I'm looking over the back fence, right? And Scott said, "What's up, Steve? Good morning. How things going?" I say, "Scott, there's something on my mind today."
All right.
I'm in the second epistle of Timothy in the Bible in chapter 1, verse 7. And this is a verse that I've had to hang on throughout my life in difficult times. And it says, "For God has not given us a spirit of fear, but of power and love and of a sound mind." Wow, that's pretty neat. And when I think about fear, I think all of us struggle from time to time with fear. And I thought maybe what we talk a little bit about, Scott, is what is this thing? Don't you think that fear drives an awful lot of our attitudes out of what we do and how we live? And I think it deeply affects far more of people's lives than they're willing to even think about or admit.
Oh, I'm sure it does. And Sean and I were talking in hour number one this morning about, I think, fear of people. A big fear that people have is going broke, losing everything. And I think that does drive a lot of people's decisions. But as I was saying to Sean, I don't think they subconsciously know that's what's going on.
I agree.
I really think in their own mind, they think the decisions they're making are great because all of a sudden they're not broke, they're feeling better. Oh, everything's great. But if it's driven by fear, I don't know that you're making the best decision.
You know, if you're depending on things and money to make you happy and to basically generate your whole mood and your goals, I mean, you're putting your money on a losing horse.
Yeah.
Because we don't know what's going to happen. I think that if we can sit back and say to ourselves and ask this question: if tomorrow I lost everything financially and had to move into a one-bedroom apartment with a few things that are really important to me, could I be okay? And I think that all of us need to be that place in our life where we can say, yeah, I would be. My life is not defined by what I have. It's wonderful what I have. I love what I have. I love where I live. And I love the things that we've done with it, and it's comfortable. But if I'm going to not live in a state of fear, I can't live in a state of what happens if I lose it. And I think you're right, Scott. An awful lot of people do. Some people may be listening thinking, I don't know what they're talking about. I've lost it already, never got it to begin with.
Yeah.
And the question is, are those people okay? Well, yeah, I think they are. We've got to quit basing happiness on money.
Why, you know, it's been there for a long time. Money is the root of all evil. Why?
No, it's not. Scripture says that the love of money,
the love of money, yes,
is the root of all evil. Not money itself, but the love of it.
So why? But do you think, now that's another point, why do you think people really think of themselves as loving money, or is it just the things that it brings? See, that's where I think people don't believe.
I think that we got to look at love in the right context. There is, as Americans. And this started happening with a lot of the romantics, but in poetry many years ago, is that we always think of love as an emotion, and love is a thing. Love is what you are sold out and dedicated to. So if you think to yourself, you know, yeah, I'm kind of sold out and dedicated to money because that's what drives me. That's not a feeling of love of money. I think sometimes people hate money. I mean, well, they wish this money issue would go away. But I think that people are driven to always get more. Why do you think there's always lines when the lottery goes up? And it's that hope that maybe my ship's going to come in. You know, your ship can come in and you never have money. I'm going to give you a minute, but I just something I want to kick into the conversation here in a second. You got something?
Oh, yeah. Well, I was just thinking to myself that I think that most people, as I said earlier, do not realize that's what they're doing, though. I think most people.
I don't think they do.
I think most people absolutely realize that they are making the best decisions in their life, even though if they really went back and looked at why they made those decisions, they would say it was prompted by the lack of money in my life, and
I agree.
That's very sad.
My sisters, I've had this discussion with one of them, and we grew up. We didn't. We were. I don't like to use that word poor because we weren't. We just didn't have any money. And it affected them far differently than it did me, or possibly even my brother. Because they were girls, only having two dresses to wear all week long was embarrassing to them. And you know what I mean? Those kind of things. To me, it didn't, you know, we always had the oldest car in a church parking lot, you know. I had no problem taking my buddy's hand-me-down Converse. Dana, if you're listening, you know what I'm talking about. But anyway, you know, I didn't care. Look, here was it. I never defined myself that way. I knew that my self-worth was as same as everyone else. God says that. You know, that He makes us all equal. We are all the same. We all have the same opportunities in Him and the opportunities with life. So I never really did that. But I think that it does affect a lot of people very, very differently when they don't have. It's very interesting, Scott. I was talking to a pastor friend of mine. And they were telling me that, you know, I never realized that I was privileged growing up or poor growing up, either one, until I was defined in college. I went to college and they told me who I was. It was all based on finances. And how sad is that? You know, when we were growing up, and I just mentioned that we didn't have a lot, but we did have a lot. We had a loving family. We had a dad that would get me out of bed on Saturday morning and take me with him wherever he was going. We had a faithful, wonderful church family. I never knew. I knew that we didn't have what other people had, but I never felt poor. And I think that we've defined poor in this country very poorly. I didn't expect, there's no reason that I expected it. I knew that I had friends, that their dads made more money than my dad. It didn't make them a better dad, never in my mind that they were. But I knew there were people around me that could afford more things than we could. But to me, that was just the way that was. I didn't look at it as, boy, we're poor. We need to be. And I think that we've tried to equalize people based on things rather than based on real self-worth.
You know, though, but I've known so many people who had the exact opposite effect of growing up with not a lot of money. They will tell you, and they're very aware of that fact, that they did not grow up with a lot. I mean, it's not that they didn't have food on the table,
right.
But they watched their parents struggle, and they were there, and they didn't always have the best clothes for school, and they didn't always, and they had to go out and get a job earlier than maybe some of their friends did, because they had to pay for their own car. Their parents couldn't do that.
All that you're describing my growing up.
But then their reaction in life is to get into a situation that is based on money where they can be taken care of and they can afford that stuff they couldn't afford before, that they can go on those trips that they could not take when they were younger, that they are never at a loss for money, because the fear in their life then always is to end up like their parents because
now
they lived it.
Now we went back to that term fear.
Absolutely. It is a fear.
Here's what I think. That the fear, we got to deal with the fear factor. And it's because, like I said, you have to understand that my joy in my life comes from the fact that I know that I belong to God, that He loves me, and that He's going to take care of me no matter where I'm at. So there, that's off the table. I know whatever happens, God's got me. It's like Paul talked about in the Bible. It says, you know, whatever state he finds himself in, he's content. Whether in chains or whether having a wonderful time and eating great, he's content because he knows that God has him. I think that that's something that we miss out on today. I think that with a lot of the lack of teaching about God and being there for us and teaching about and having churches that kids go to regularly, I always had that hope in the back of my mind. There was always hope. There was always a tomorrow. And when we define ourselves with physical things, there's not always that hope, because you might get to the end of you just don't see a way out. And I think that's part of the reason today we see the rise in so many suicides, is because people just don't see a way out. Well, if we believe that with God, there's always a way out, because we have to get away from defining ourselves by what we have or we don't have and understand who we are. You look at some of the greatest people in history, in our history. Look at George Washington Carver. And these are people that never had anything. You know, some of the greatest people came from nothing. Abraham Lincoln by no means was a wealthy young man. And the point is, they had a drive and said, you know what, I can. Now, I will say this. My sisters, who struggled with the fact they didn't have anything, that's the other part. It doesn't mean that you need to just accept the fact that you're poor and be that way. I didn't mean that. They knew that what you had depended on what you did to work for it and do it. Now, both of my sisters have been semi-overachievers. One sister was a vice president with a major bank for many, many years, and the other sister was a successful teacher for many years. Matter of fact, she was chosen to be one of the first teachers on a delegation to Russia after the Cold War was over. So these were very successful, good people.
You know, that is such an interesting point, though, and I hate to cut you off there, but success does not equal great finances. Sometimes it does. But would you rather have success or great finances? I think the most fulfilling thing is success.
It's success in whatever you do. I mean, you can be in the best at whatever you do. And what does that mean? I mean, I know people that people will remember forever because they did great carvings.
Exactly.
Or, you know, you don't have to. Great finances. I've known a lot of people with great finances that when they pass away, there's literally a handful of people at their funeral.
You know, some people will get this and some people won't, because I'm not going to say the name, but the name is synonymous with Marion. But I got to know this person very well. And because of the life they led, and because of the position that they held, I think people always thought they had a lot of money. Everybody in town knew this name. They knew who it was, without question. And when they died, it was a big deal that they died because they were very successful in their field. But I also was in their home, and they did not have money. They had enough money to live. They weren't destitute.
And I'd be willing to bet that they were very content in life.
Loved life. Till the day they died.
Till the day they died. And there you go. I mean, the point is, we put too much on money. And the thing that we do to try to equalize and make everybody try to look the same is not helping. I'll give you a good example. When I was growing up, Scott, there were things I would never have because I never expected to have them. We couldn't afford them. I wasn't going to get the latest bicycle. I wasn't going to get, I knew if I had was going to drive, that meant I had to get a job. I had to buy a car. I had to. Now, people helped me along the way. People sometimes would lend me a couple $100 to buy that car, but I had to pay them back. And the point is that today, we got to equalize everyone. No matter what your income level is, you got to have a cell phone. You got to have internet. You got to have this. We all got to have our Nikes or whatever the popular shoe at the time. We all have to have whatever. You know, and it's like, why are you trying to make everyone look the same when they're not the same? I mean, one of the things that drove me as a young person, I was content with the fact that we didn't have anything. But the fact is, I always knew, here's the thing, Scott, I always knew if I wanted something, this was the land of opportunity and all I had to do was work for it. And that's what drove me as a young person. I remember one of my goals, this is kind of funny, one of my goals as a young adult was I was going to retire by the time I was 50, and I wanted to be on about a 1,000-acre ranch somewhere and just be enjoying life and have a bunch of money. And I initially started out working towards that goal. But it was really weird. Every time that I would think about that and what it would be like, I would get more of a depressed feeling than a happy feeling. And evidently, you know, God's let me know, you know, this isn't going to make you happy, Steve. And and of course, ultimately, being a pastor, my life took a lot different turn, not independently wealthy. But the point being that I always knew that I never begrudged people that had things because I knew and I was raised to believe my parents were very well balanced in this. They didn't gripe about people that had money. They had great friends that had a lot of money. They didn't, on the other side of the coin, I had family members later in life, extended family that would say, oh, you know, the only reason they got anything is so they stole from everyone or they ripped people off or they did this. I've never kissed anyone's blah, blah, blah to get what. You know how that negative attitude is. You've seen it out there. But my parents were very balanced and let me know, look, you know, this is what they have because of what they do. They went to college and got that degree because they wanted to be a doctor. They wanted to be a dentist. That guy wanted to be an engineer. That guy got in with a great company early on and rose with it. You know, there's people that are very well. I know of one particular man, and everyone would know this name too, so I won't mention it, that is probably one of the wealthiest people in Marion County by far. Nobody would know it, but we had a discussion a few weeks ago. And he was telling me that when he was 18 years old, he saw something really, really great to invest in. And he borrowed the money to invest in it. And he invested in it. And when he did, he immediately, within 2 or 3 years, just the dividends off that brought him six figures his entire life. And that was just one thing. So the point is, my family always made it clear, yeah, they have a nicer house than me, but that's because of the route they took. They're no better. And I think that we need more of that here. You know, the woe is me about one thing that drives me nuts, and I say that quite often, but if I tell you it drives me nuts, it drives me nuts, is this, when you do something great or you're going somewhere or you go to a nice place to eat or you buy something or you get something, and so it must be nice. Well, you know what? Yeah, it is nice. And you know what? If you want to go do it, go. You see what I mean? I'm not being cold. I'm just saying if you have that it must be nice attitude, I can promise you today you're never going to have anything.
You know, it's interesting that you bring this up, because very early on in life, I would say maybe in high school, but certainly in college, I came to a realization that I was never going to talk finances with people, no matter who it was, and I was never going to personal finances, and I was never going to pay or try to show anything off to anybody, whether it be a friend or a relationship, because when you do that, when you buy everything, when you go to extravagances, you can never be sure if they like you or they like what you're doing for them. And if you stop, you will find out very quickly. And I think there's a lot of that going on.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that's why we have to be guarded in what we do. First of all, if you I don't have a lot to do it, so I don't know that I'd ever be too much of in a position to do this anyway. But I think that when you have a lot, you have to be careful that you don't overgift people on a regular basis. Because in all fairness, what may happen sometimes, if you start pulling back, they may think, what did I do to them?
Right. Well, and also, this is not just financial. If you start doing everything for them, that is also an interesting thing, because a lot of people's fear is not being able to get everything done. And if all of a sudden you've got somebody coming in doing everything for you, well, that probably feels pretty good. But do you like the person, or do you like the fact that they're doing things that you need done?
Well, if you really need them done, I guess maybe you like the fact they're getting things done. But I think that we should try to look with money. No matter where you are, whether you have a little bit or whether you have a lot, comes a great responsibility. You have the responsibility to do first things first, what's right with it and what you should do with it. And whether, even if you have a lot of money, you have the responsibility to not use it as a bartering tool to get people to like you.
But people do. The guy who picks up the tab, the woman who always gets the drink for somebody, you know, if your thing consists always of your friendship, let's say a friendship, let's this weekend go here and I'll buy. Well, okay, but, you know, I don't know. I think that's dangerous territory.
Yeah, I think so. I don't know. I don't know where I want to go with that. I'm getting what you're saying. I understand that. And I think it's dangerous territory, too. But I just think there's something wrong with that whole relationship. I think, like I said, the person with a lot of money has the responsibility to realize that maybe this isn't the healthiest thing to be doing all the time.
Exactly.
Maybe it's not the healthiest thing to pick up the tab all the time. I have friends that I know are far better off than I am. And when we go out to get something to eat, it's usually a tit for tat. You know, I may buy one time, they may buy the next, or we buy our own, whatever the case may be. I have other friends, and I have a couple friends that don't have any more than I do, that they insist on buying, and they do that. And see, I recognize why they're doing it. They're doing it because it's a little something that they can do for me as a friend or as their pastor that they want to do. And I'm not going to steal their joy. That's something else we have to be careful about. When someone wants to do something for you and you can tell that it's out of the goodness of their heart, you know they're a genuine person, don't rob their joy by saying, oh, no, I'm not going to let you do
no,
that.
No, no. I mean, I think one of the big secrets of life is to give. You know, I think that makes people very happy. The problem is what is your motive for giving? That's where we get into a very gray area.
You gave me something last week. No big deal.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
But you didn't do that for any particular reason other than the fact that you knew that I would like what that was.
Right.
That was why. When we come in the morning and something as simple as a drink or
right.
something, you know, that's something, yeah, Scott would love to have that. I don't do it thinking, man, I got to keep Scott on the up and up. And
right.
and I think that when you have that kind of attitude, there's your problem. Mm-hmm. You know, it all comes back to attitude. Why are you doing something? Are you doing it out of the goodness of your heart? And I still swear to this day that any goodness I have in my heart comes through the Lord, because inherently we can be selfish people. And, you know, God gave liberally without a bad motive one. And he wants us to do the same. I think he wants us to care about people. It's just like when you do charities, when you do things like that. Now, sometimes you know, I'll talk about things the church do, and it's not because I'm trying to hold the church up and say, look what we do. It's because I want other people to know that, you know what, come and get involved. This is the kind, this is somewhere you will like these kind of things. It's something that we do. So I do that. But if we think that the goods that we do are to benefit us right now, we're in a bad place. We're just like that wealthy person that's given buying all the meals to get the loyalty of someone. You know, I don't think that we should do that. I think it literally needs to be from the goodness of our heart.
Well, you know what I've noticed when you said earlier the person, one of the richest people probably in Marion County, but people wouldn't know it. Well, my guess is the reason people probably wouldn't know it is that they don't pick up the tab all the time. They don't buy stuff. They don't drive the biggest car and the newest car. They don't have the biggest or the best house. And I think people who are successful and do have some money probably don't live that way. You know, when I first went into college, I worked at a bank in Richwood, Ohio. Now, Richwood, Ohio is not a rich community, but I can tell you that I knew what people had in their bank accounts because I worked at the bank. And it was the old day where if you deposited it, you saw what their balance was. And some of the people who drove the oldest cars and lived in the oldest houses, who you would have thought were one step away from the street, had hundreds of thousands of dollars in their checking
account. And sometimes that's a bad thing, too. Money hoarding is very bad when you don't use it for good things. And maybe they were, maybe they wouldn't. But the person that I'm talking about, I will say this, they do kind things, and they do things, but they do it in a measured way. They don't put their name out there and say, put their name on everything. I've never seen this person one time put their name on any charitable deed or act that they've done. And I know they've done a lot, but I've never seen their name on anything, and no one would even know that they do it. And they don't want people to know that they do it. They want to do it because they want to do it. And the people that, and the things that they help, by no way are those people going to, in any greatly way, be able to do anything back for them. So it's a good place. Frank, you got something to say? There's smoke coming out of Frank's
ears. Here we go.
Speak up here, Frank.
Oh, yeah. This one's after. Okay. Just the mere fact of giving because love tells you to give.
Right.
Remember the years that we volunteered with Salvation Army?
Yes.
Okay. I was at times stationed at a more affluent shopping center.
Mm-hmm.
And other times I was stationed at the one that was down on Sandusky Street, the old Kroger store.
Yeah.
An observation I've made was that at the affluent, we collected more money, but less people gave.
Less percentage.
The percentage-wise. And down at the old Kroger's store, Kroger's, the poor, the less affluent, more of them gave, but it was less amount.
Very interesting. You mentioned, I've mentioned this many times, that when I was stationed at the, you don't remember the Odd Lots was in Delaware next to where the BMV is?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, that was not, it was something before Odd Lots. But anyway, it was a store. And I was stationed there as a ringing bell for the Salvation Army. And I noticed the same thing. People that were obviously somewhat affluent would just turn their head when they come out. Not all of them. They turn their head when they come out the door. And the people that didn't have anything not only would come up and at least throw change in, but they'd give it to their kids and show them
sure.
to help other people. And I think that sometimes you have to be there to understand. One attitude that really bothers me, and it's not fair at all, is the attitude that a lot of people have when they are well off, is that, well, they're poor because they deserve to be poor. They didn't do what, you know, and people don't understand, you know, walk a mile in my shoes. You've heard that before. You know, walk a mile in people's shoes, you understand. You know, there's generational poverty. And when you grow up in poverty, and your grandparents were in poverty, and your great-grandparents were in poverty, you know what you learn? You learn poverty. Unless you can learn find a way. I had the greatest parents in the world, because I'm telling you, you would have never known we weren't the richest people in the world, and we didn't have anything. My mom made our clothes most of the time. She planted a garden that would blow your mind, because that's what we ate out of all year. They loved us dearly, and they taught us our self-worth was not in what we had physically or didn't have. But it left me with a positive attitude to know that, you know, I can have anything if I want, if I can work for it. And that's the point we need to be at today, I think, is understanding if you don't want to live in poverty, you've got to work your way out of it. The government is not going to benefit you your way out of it. It may look like it initially, but eventually they're going to own you, and you're going to be stuck where you're at. Matter of fact, I know someone right now that is stuck in that position. They're living in a subsidized housing. They can't work. And the reason they can't work is they're on a particular disability, and their medical is extremely high. And if they go to work, they'll lose so much they can't afford to live. Now, something's wrong with that picture. Don't you agree? Shouldn't that person, you know, be able to say, look, hey, Uncle Sam, I want to work my way out of this. Can you help me just a little bit to get on my feet rather than making me 100% dependent on you? And, you know, obviously in our government, the more dependent we are on them, the more we're going to vote for those that want to help our dependents not be independent. You know, we're going to go for those programs or what we want. And I think that we're really hurting America when we don't teach self-worth based on something other than finances.
Well, I don't think the problem is, I think in all these situations, whether it's the government, whether it's somebody buying you is really what it is in the end. It's unfortunate, but that's what it is. It all has to do with self-worth. If you don't feel that you're enough, if you don't feel you're a happy person, if you're not happy with yourself, how in the world can you be happy truly with anybody else? Now, you can have momentary happiness, because it is nice if you're struggling with finances and all of a sudden somebody comes in and alleviates that burden, or you're stuck at home every weekend and you can't afford to go anywhere and all of a sudden somebody's paying for you to go somewhere every weekend. Yeah, that's great. But you know what? In the end, I think that says something more about you than the other person.
Oh, I agree. You know, it's interesting when we read about Zacchaeus in the Bible. And most of you know the story about Zacchaeus. Jesus was traveling, and Zacchaeus was this little tiny short man that climbed up in a sycamore tree to watch as Jesus went by because he couldn't see over the crowd. Well, the thing about Zacchaeus was he was very wealthy, and he was a tax collector. And tax collectors at that time, the deal is this. The Romans said, you need to collect taxes for us. But beyond what those taxes are, you can gouge them for whatever you want. And of course, Zacchaeus did that as most. That's why tax collectors were so despised. But Zacchaeus, when, you know, Jesus stopped him and said, you know, Zacchaeus, I'm coming to your place tonight. And he realized he had a change of heart. He understood what he was supposed to be like, who he was supposed to be through Christ. He came back and he said, I'm going to repay everybody. How many fold, Frank?
Tenfold, was it? No, hundredfold.
No, it wasn't a hundredfold.
Tenfold.
That one slips my mind. There's that. But anyway, he said, I'm going to go back. I'm repaying everyone that I ripped off. Mm-hmm. And you know, it just goes to show you that when your attitude's in the right place, that the love, the desire, the hoarding of that money can go away real fast. And I think personally, I think that you're going to be better off financially when you give than when you receive.
I think you're right. And you know, the story that always resonated with me was, I had a very, very, very good friend. And this person is a good person. And I'm not saying they're not a good person. But you could always tell this person wanted to be married, because they got engaged several times throughout their life. They never went through with the marriage. Or the person marrying them didn't want to go through with the marriage with them. But they never went through with it. And then they started hanging out with a person who worked at a hospital who made a fair amount of money. And that they moved in with that person, and the marriage did happen. And all of a sudden, the person was able to drive a new car because the other person facilitated that. and they had the big honeymoon and went to the Bahamas or whatever, and these trips, the marriage lasted a little over 1 year. Because when it all came push to shove, when it finally came down, it really was just based in money. But it, by the time that dawned on this person, too late.
Yep. Frank just looked that up. It was four times Zacchaeus paid him back.
I was hoping somebody would call in and give us the...
Well, you got it. Four times he gave back. You know, I have a similar situation with a cousin that they spent an astronomical amount of money on this wedding, and it didn't last a year. And yeah. why are we? You wonder why in the world are we even doing that kind of stuff? Money's an interesting thing. When you don't have it, you always want it. And once you get it, you can be miserable because you're afraid of losing it. And I asked someone very close to me one time. I said, "Why don't you help a particular person more than you do?" And their comment to me was, "Because I'm afraid of going back." Ending up back where if I get, if I help too many people and too many people take, I'm afraid of going back to where we were. And my thought with them was, I remember you back where you were, and you were a happier person then than you are now. Money has not made you happy. It's just made you paranoid. And the point that you have to, what are we doing when can you honestly say that we're a healthier, more content person when we're scared to death of losing our money?
No, and I, it also comes to back to this fear where we started here. I mean, of course, there is the fear of money, but you know what? There else in people's life is a huge fear is a fear of failure.
Mm-hmm.
Fear that they failed at something. Fear that they have failed at life. In general, because when you get to a certain point in your life, you start to look back and say, well, what have I done here? What have
oh
I done?
My. I have a, you don't know the amount of people that on their deathbed, because as a pastor, I'm with a lot of people on their deathbed, the amount of people over the years that have said to me, I know I was here for a purpose, but I don't know what it is. Or here's another big one. I was so busy out there trying to make it in life that my family never got to know me. My
yes.
kids don't even know who I am. How heartbreaking is that? That's a very, another thing that gets me, Scott, is that people will rationalize why they do what they do when it comes to money. Now, and I'm going to pick on you, church, for a minute. Can I pick on the church?
Go right ahead.
Okay, I'm picking on the church. there's people in the church that will point a finger at how somebody looks, how they dress, how they, oh, did you see what that person was doing? Oh, what a horrible Christian testimony that is, blah, 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 blah. But yet at the same time, they can work somewhere that supports some of the most ludicrous, lewd things that you can even imagine. But because the money they're making, they rationalize being there. And you tell me that that's any better than the person that may be doing something like, oh my word, I saw them doing. You see what I mean? When it comes to money, for some reason, we're able to rationalize what we do to get it. It's not right. Cheating's cheating, stealing's stealing, lying. It doesn't change. And I think that it's pretty bad when a person, a secular person out in the world can be a better example of being honest than someone with themselves. We have to gut check. Gut checks are important. And we have to have another thing that's out there important is accountability people around you, wherever you're at. With me, I find it with those that are close to me in the church. And I think it's a great place to have good accountability friends because they got to be willing to take the same criticism you are. I was talking to I was at a event one time with Kurt Warner, who was, quarterback, NFL quarterback. And he and a couple other guys, former football players that they'd been on teams with around the country, were three accountability partners. And once a week, they would have a conference call and gut check each other. Well, this guy was having real problems in his marriage but wasn't telling his wife. And his buddies told him on the phone, said, well, we're going to give you 1 week to tell her what's going on, or we're calling your wife and telling her you're having problems. Now, is that an accountability partner or what?
Well, that's...
And you know what? He did, and everything worked out. But that's what a true account... And he was willing to say, okay, guys, That's how much you got to have someone close enough to you you can trust.
You know, that's interesting you bring that up, because I did not realize for the longest time how people who have been divorced or maybe multiple divorces, how much that makes them feel like a failure. How that's real touchy.
Marriage is a big thing.
Well, it is, but I guess if you leave it, and you decide that you're leaving it, for whatever reason you're leaving it, I would hope it's a good reason that you're getting out of it. So to look back on it, I just would think that you would not be ashamed or feel yourself a failure in that area. But you know what? It doesn't, because they keep on going and getting married again.
Let's look at something on a more simple basis.
But it's always going to work out.
If say that you're telling everybody you're going to be a veterinarian, and you've said it for years, you start college, you're in there, and all of a sudden you just flunk out of school 3 years into it. You're always going to feel like a failure because of that, right? And that's something just simple in life. When you stand at an altar before God and before people and say, you know, I'm going to love you and for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, in sickness and health, as long as we live. And that's a commitment. At that time, in your mind, you believe that, I hope.
I would think.
And the other person talking to you believes that, they hope. Well, when that ends, why wouldn't you have a feeling of failure? Of course you would.
Well, that, I get that, but I'm talking multiples. Because once you've done
this
multiple...
They want to correct the mistake.
But how many times do you got to correct?
They haven't corrected the mistake because a lot of times what happens is they jump from the skillet into the frying pan.
There you go.
They'll go after the same kind of person, or they won't resolve their own issues going into it, and they carry the same issues into the next marriage. If we can't be content with ourselves and who we are inside, we're never going to be content with another person.
But that's what I'm... Don't those people need accountability?
Absolutely.
Because clear... Doesn't... After about, you know... I mean, let's...
A good friend needed to sit down and say, hey, Joan... She used the name Joan. Hey, Joan, we need to talk.
But
but when you do that, you also got to be willing to say, look, here's my issues. I'm there too. I'm no better than you, but I'm as your friend, I love you, and I'm going to talk to you about this. And you can either face it or not face it. And you know what? A good accountability partner is able to do that.
But I don't think they ever do face it, because I think it comes back to the money thing as well. They don't believe they're in it for that reason. It's always... It's like a Disney movie. It's always different this time. It's always different this time. And, you know, it's hard to talk... You know, somebody said the other day, a young friend of mine who's in his early 20s is talking about it getting engaged for the first time. Now, maybe it'll go on for 50 years and they'll be happy and it'll be wonderful. But he said the fateful words that I knew, no matter what I said at that point, it didn't matter. You know, I could go and say, are you really sure? You've only been around this girl a year. Before I give that spiel, he said, she's the one. And I knew once he said that, I could give him every reason why he should wait or think it's over. He ain't going to wait.
You know, I'll give you an example of you know, expecting things to be different. You know, every society in history, throughout history, when they've gone down a road of total sexual immorality and certainly of socialism in that form, has immediately within 50 to 60 years disintegrated as a society. We're doing that in this country right now, but we have all these people saying it'll be different with us. No, it won't. Look at history. They say that those who fail to recognize history are doomed to repeat it. And it's the same thing in marriages. It's the same thing in family and finances. Look, as we go off the air, which we're about to.
About a minute, yeah.
I want to say this, that, you know, first of all, you know, I believe that your true confidence and your true comfort, which he gives us, are going to be found in Jesus Christ. And I invite you to come to the church and to hear about that. The other thing is, I want to let you know, you're never going to be happy until you learn to accept how things are and move forward from that point. And the other last thing is, we have to, even if they're guilty, we have to stop blaming other people, because the minute that we blame, it takes all of our personal drive away. Frank, you had something real quick you were going to say a minute ago.
You know, with age,
yeah,
it comes and goes. So I forgot what I was going to interject.
Well, there you go.
Well, you know what? All I'll say is when we talk about no history, or you're doomed to repeat it. Personal history is a part of that too. It's
absolutely
not just world history.
That's right.
And you better remember about
remember,
your personal history.
Yeah. Hey, great show, Scott. Good to have you, and love you guys.
Absolutely. We got about 10 seconds left here, so I will remind you this show will replay on Sunday morning, 8 a.m., and Wednesday and Thursday at 3 p.m. All right, we are out.
WWGH Radio LP Marion, Ohio. The Talking Place. For former coach of the Ohio State Buckeyes, Jim Tressel.
You know, it's interesting because everybody knows the story, obviously, of what happened there. But when that all was going down, because that's a rough period.